Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Priya's preferred pronouns are she, her, hers. She is a licensed mental health counselor with credentials, alcohol and substance use counselor with experience providing individual psychotherapy, relationship counseling, and sex therapy. She is in the process of becoming a certified sex therapist with emphasis on the alternative relationships. She's being certified through ASSET, which is the American Association of Sexually Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. She holds a bachelor's degree in psychology and a master's degree in mental health counseling.
And joining her, we also have Dr. Daryl Ray. He is the founder and president of Recovering from Religion. He has been a psychologist for over 30 years and is the author of 4 books, including The God Virus, How Religion Infects Our Lives and Culture, and very apropos to the topic on hand today, Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality. Dr. Ray has been a student of religion for most of his life and holds a master's degree in religion, as well as a bachelor's degree in sociology and anthropology, with a doctorate in psychology. He has lectured around the world on sexuality and the myth of sex and porn addiction. Dr. Ray and Priya, thank you so much for being here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to be here, guys.
Bear with me. I'm kind of nervous. All right.
Hey, there's nothing to be nervous about. It's just sex.
So, welcome, everybody. My name is Priya, and I masturbate. So, this conversation, we're going to be talking on a couple of very interesting topics. As a intro, I want to make sure this does not feel like high school sex ed. Like, I don't want this to be me rambling on and boring everyone half to death. I want this to be more interactive. If you have any questions, any kind of comments, feel free to let us know in the chat. We are going to be talking on a few topics, but I am open to all sorts of flexibility when it comes to this thing. So
I am super glad that this isn't high school sex ed. I tell you what, my sex ed was taught to me by my football coach, and he didn't know much about anything except football. So I probably got a poor sex ed, you know, and I imagine most of the folks that are here got pretty darn poor sex ed if they lived in the United States.
Well, Eric, I got to say that your sex education was a lot better than mine because I didn't get none. It's something you didn't talk about. So. Mm-hmm.
So that's part of what we're going to be kind of discussing today. We're going to be discussing a lot of maybe information that was given to us at a young age, and a lot of us still struggle with it today. Before we jump straight into it, I want to just take a quick moment to make sure everyone understood the topics that today we're going to be discussing. I don't want it to be heteronormative. I don't want it to be cisgendered focused. I want this to be as inclusive as humanly possible. So I'm going to try my best to use vocabulary that is inclusive. I want to make sure everyone understands what a sect is. So it's a professional association that they set the minimum standard for training in the field. So for example, I'm in the process of becoming fully certified as a sex therapist. I'm already a licensed psychotherapist. So if you are looking for a therapist that you would like to discuss topics of sexuality with, generally we recommend it to go to a sex site. And that way you can find someone that has received training in this topic and is not uncomfortable with it. Because unfortunately, oftentimes we go to therapists and we would love to discuss certain topics, but we may begin to, and we can kind of see that little moment of hesitation in the therapist themselves. And then we go, oh, okay, I can't talk about this with this person. And then that often leads to even more shame in a lot of people, even more silence, and just the stigma of a lot of beliefs can just, it just perpetuates.
So, if you're a therapist or a counselor who was certified through the AASECT, mm-hmm. what credentials would we kind of look for after the name? Do they have any credentials after their name?
So, generally, anyone on ASEC, there's a directory where you would look. Okay. So, someone on ASEC would generally already be a licensed therapist or either a marriage and family therapist or a mental health counselor, and you find, you know, you can look it up by location and everything. So it's, I always recommend that, just because like you were saying, sometimes you'll have that experience of you'll look for a therapist and they can't talk about certain things. And obviously if you are looking for a secular sex therapist, it can sometimes be even more challenging. So I always recommend that to people from the beginning, just to avoid the headache and wasting your own time and going through that experience, which is amazingly uncomfortable.
So I dropped a link in there for that directory in case anyone is looking for a therapist. In
those fabulous. So, yeah. Fabulous.
Now, Doctor, all right. Have you been through this kind of training yourself? Can you hear me, Dr. Ray?
Oh, yeah. I didn't hear you addressing me. I'm sorry. Actually, no, I have not been through the training. That's why Priya is leading this discussion, because she knows more about it than I do. So keep on keeping on there, Priya. I don't know anything about sex, Eric. I just know I masturbate, but not as much as Priya does. I don't know. I am concerned, Priya, I am really concerned that in the COVID, this COVID virus thing, that people are masturbating too much. So I'm very interested in finding out about what's the limits on, you know, masturbating during a crisis, a pandemic.
Oh, we're going to get to that in a minute. before we begin, when it comes to sex therapy itself, we generally use a model that's called the PLISSIT model. That's PLISSIT. It stands for permission, limited information, specific suggestions, and intensive therapy. So we are going to be doing right now the first piece of it, which is permission. So I'm officially granting everyone in attendance here permission to ask these questions, permission to be curious, to whatever it is that you want to know, you officially have permission. And oftentimes, this model is very recommended, because a lot of times people go to physicians, for example, like they may go to their primary care provider, and they aren't given that permission by their doctor to discuss these things. So, for example, a lot of doctors may ask you one question about your sexuality, maybe, if they do. Oftentimes, they do not. They'll just kind of jump over that question, and it just doesn't get asked. And I've heard cases of people with, for example, pain during sex, and it's been going on for years, untreated, because they either no one ever asked the question, they didn't feel comfortable enough to share it with their doctor, or they just assumed it was normal because they weren't given that sex education regarding what can be generally expected during sex. So I'm officially giving everyone permission to ask questions, be curious, and it's okay. You know, like, I'm here to answer whatever doubts you may have. So the first topic on the agenda is masturbation. So I unfortunately am not able to see the poll results.
Hey, I can see the poll results. You ready?
If you can, that would be lovely.
Absolutely. The first question was, were you ever told that masturbation is a sin? And 57% of the folks said yes. 23% said no, and the remaining 21% weren't sure.
Okay. So masturbation is an interesting topic. A lot of times we were taught things that generally are harmful when it comes to masturbation, or it just wasn't discussed at all. I know a lot of people grew up with this idea that masturbation itself was evil, or it was sinful, or something to be ashamed of, something to be hidden away and never discussed ever. And then oftentimes that can reflect in relationships, in sometimes damaging ways, because, like, for example, I don't know how many times I've heard the situation of, I have a partner who feels I should not be masturbating because now we are together, therefore they have no need to masturbate. I don't see how those two things cannot go together. You can have a happy, healthy relationship and have a happy, healthy sex life with yourself. And I think a lot of people, they unfortunately did not grow up with a healthy sex life just with themselves. And that's generally, like, that's where we should start. Like, when did you discover pleasure? Generally, we discover it by ourselves first, you know? So when it comes to masturbation, yes, go ahead.
I think that, how would you think a good way to kind of approach this with a partner would be? Like, if the partner thinks that, you know, shouldn't be masturbating.
Okay, so I would ask them, well, so we're assuming that let's throw a scenario out there that they caught me. Let's say they caught me red-handed. So it's about having that open, honest conversation of what is it that you believe about this. Like, when it comes to therapy, I utilize a lot of REBT, where we really go to the beliefs, because generally it's the belief around it that we need to work on. So, for example, REBT, Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy.
Okay, REBT.
So, for example, if in my mind, catching my partner masturbating, in my head, that means, oh, that means I'm not satisfying them. That means that I'm not good enough for them. That means that I'm boring them. Well, then, yes, obviously, in for me, this is a threat. This is bad. This is very bad. And I will most likely have a very bad reaction to it. And then I may, you know, start accusing them, like, oh, you don't love me. You don't do all this. And oftentimes that's where it just, it gets much bigger, much more complicated to work on. When you could just sit down and have a conversation about, this is something I do for me. I enjoy it. Some people, they use it for stress relief. Some people use it just to relax. Some people use it just because they do it because it's enjoyable. It feels good. And we have all the right to just feel good. And there's nothing wrong with that. So you can have that conversation with a partner and kind of throw it back to them. Like, what does it make you feel when I'm doing this? And ask them, like, well, it makes me feel threatened. It makes me feel insecure. It makes me feel like I don't know what's going on. I like to recommend invite them into the process if you want to. Some people, they really enjoy, you know, shared masturbation time. You could do it next to each other. You could just observe. You could, if it is something that works for you as a couple or more than a couple, you know, whatever relationship situation you're in, it really kind of, it's a very individual thing. Not everybody wants to share their masturbation process with their partner. Some people, they do like it to be like their own thing.
Yeah.
So it's about having that conversation.
I'm sorry. One of the things I've heard people say is like, well, if you masturbate, then that means you don't want to have sex with your partner.
Mm. Yeah, that's really common. And those two things have nothing to do with each other. Like, it is absolutely possible to have an amazing sex life with your partner and also have an amazing sex life with yourself. There's nothing wrong with that. And
oh, so you're saying that masturbating is, I guess, I've never thought of it that way. With yourself. Oh, so I feel like a 14-year-old now. Look, this is what my football coach did to me, for crying out loud. I never thought about that. Masturbating and having sex. Okay. All right. Carry on. I'm sorry.
Like, I love asking people, like, where did you really start this process of figuring out your own, you know, your own sexuality? Like, of when did you first start to realize you felt aroused? How did that feel for you? Like, some people, it was a scary experience. For some people, it's really rewarding, and some people, it's very exciting. So everyone's process is very different. It really, most of the time, it's influenced by what's going on around them, family, you know, society, all these extras that are on the outside. But for me, it's amazingly important to be comfortable with ourselves. And that way we can, you know, I love using masturbation as a way to teach my partner what I like. So that's another thing I encourage highly of, you know, just have that moment of like, hey, give them like a tutorial. You know, these are my genitals 101. This is what to do. This is what not to do. And oftentimes when we see relationships together for sexual issues, sometimes it is just that of having to work with them on communicating what they like, what they don't like, and what maybe they would like to try, but maybe they've never had that conversation because they felt uncomfortable about it, or it was awkward, or just a little scary, or they were afraid of what their partner may say. So they just kind of put it off as maybe I'll just talk about it later. Sometimes the, you know, people will be watching pornography to what they want to do. Sometimes maybe not. It could just be fantasy, you know, like these, everyone is very individual when it comes to their own sexuality and what turns them on. But the same, I love that don't yuck their yum. Like that applies here as well. And oftentimes, unfortunately, like I can tell a partner, hey, I'm really into this. And then they go, ooh, I don't know about that. And then how's that making me feel? Now I'm feeling a certain kind of way about that because now I feel like I've been judged, or I feel like, you know, like what I like is now downgraded. And that can oftentimes, if it's something really important to me, it can hurt my feelings a lot. So communication is huge, and just be open about it. And that can be very scary for a lot of people. When it comes to addiction and masturbation, that's a huge topic that Daryl is also very familiar with, this topic. And it's a myth. Okay, who's the one who decided what is normal is always what we like to ask. Like, where did that definition come from? Who came out and was like, you're allowed to masturbate 3 times a week? More than that, nah, you have a problem, you need to stop. Like, there's no number. It's all about, for you personally, if it causes any sort of problem that you have identified, not that the therapist has identified or your partner has identified, it's you yourself. If you have decided, hey, I'm noticing an issue here, I'm masturbating, let's throw a number out there, 10 times a day, and it's causing some issues that I would like to maybe address, okay, cool. I'm not going to call it a sex addiction because it's not even recognized by like the boards, and you know, it doesn't exist in any book per se. Like, you can't diagnose someone with a sex addiction. It doesn't exist. But we can say that some people can self-identify of having problematic sexual behaviors, and I can say that maybe someone could use some assistance in terms of figuring out a way where they can still masturbate and still find pleasure and not negatively affect other parts of their lives.
What kind of signs, like if I were to want to identify that in myself, or what kind of signs would I be looking for that it may be addictive, or I may be addicted to it?
Well, generally it's all about the negative consequences. My first question would be generally about how much time in a day you're dedicating to it. Some people have no problem literally separating a chunk of their day to that, which is cool. Mm-hmm. But some people, when it extends into a little bit longer of a period than they would like if they say, all right, an hour a day is cool with me, but I'm noticing I'm venturing into like the 3-4 hours a day territory, and I might want to like cut that down. That's something that we would talk about. Other types of signs might be bodily harm, even though that's not a go-to for every single person, because there are some people that enjoy a little bit of bodily harm. So we would have to kind of see, all right, is it that you're masturbating to the point where now you're causing a little bit of chafing and a little bit of irritation? And what ways can we work on that? Maybe we want to include, using lube into the routine because, you know, maybe the person doesn't want to go down in frequency, but they just don't want it to hurt so much. And then we would probably go, all right, let's try some lube out. But it's a very personal thing. Some people, their partner's reaction would also be something that they would take into account of if my partner is uncomfortable with it or if they're going back and forth about it, then sometimes they would bring the partner in and we would have a conversation about how can we kind of bring this to a place where everyone's happy. Because I don't want people to kind of feel like they have to go into hiding about it, because it's not about that either.
Like to hide it from their partner or something like that? Or...
Yeah. Like there's a big difference between privacy and secrecy. Mm-hmm. I don't see anything wrong with me and my alone time going and, you know, masturbating by myself. I don't see anything wrong with that. I don't see as that being a secret per se. But some partners, they feel like they have to hide when they masturbate because it just is received so negatively. So really, it does become something secretive.
I really do like that distinction between privacy versus secrecy. Yeah, I like that. Thank you for making that distinction.
I would jump in and say one little thing about underlining what Priya said about beliefs. If you listen carefully to what Priya is saying, it all is our behaviors in this area is hugely predicated on the beliefs we were taught. And so many of those beliefs came right out of religion and make us feel shame and guilt about our bodies. You know, our body images, we're taught what we can and can't do with our bodies. And all those are underlying beliefs that need to be challenged, and challenged in a way that gives us permission to experiment and teaches our partners that we have a right for our own. We have a right to have a relationship with ourselves, and we will, I think we haven't really gotten there yet. I know Pariah will, but it's kind of answering your question, Eric, about the couples thing. I have a right to have my own sexual relationship with myself. I also, if I want to have a positive sexual relationship with my partner, I need to reserve some of my energy for that partner. And that is one area that I think I've seen, and probably jump in here if you got something to add to that, but people masturbate to the point they don't have any energy for their partner, and that causes problems. And that, it doesn't mean they're it means they need to probably reprioritize or relearn. And there's one other thing I've noticed, and I don't know if you've seen it probably, but I've seen people get out of religion and their masturbatory behavior actually goes down because they get over the shame and guilt that was driving so much of that behavior. Anyway, that's my two cents.
So are you saying that people that are religious masturbate more than people who aren't?
Oh, yeah. I can confess to that myself. I don't know that it happens to everybody, but I have seen that clinically. Brian, have you seen anything like that?
Well, it depends. You know, everyone is so different about it. But mm-hmm. I feel like generally the way it's viewed can be very different. You know, it depends on whether you talk to someone, for example, let's say per se, a penis owner. I'm trying not to use the word male in this one per se, but let's say the way it's viewed by different genders can be different. I know a lot of men, self-identified men, when they masturbate, it's seen as something shameful. And then women, it's almost like we're not taught about it at all. Like, I don't know, a lot of women I've spoken to, it just wasn't something discussed. It was like self-pleasure was just not even a thing. It was not allowed in some places, or just it wasn't seen as proper. So a lot of times we grow up with this vision of sex as just dirty. And unfortunately, a lot of times it's difficult to shake that point of view and our beliefs. Like you said, like what we believe about things shapes how we act and how we feel. So if I believe that every time I touch myself, I'm doing something that's evil and dirty, it's going to negatively affect how I feel about myself and how I feel about my relationships. I may not allow my partner to touch me in certain places because I don't feel he should or she should or they should because it automatically makes them dirty as well. And then we're caught in this like spiral of self-hate in a lot of times. So
someone who is in that trap of self-shaming and stuff, how can they overcome that?
Well, it's a process, definitely. It takes quite a bit of time of, I would say it's a combination of things. When it comes to sex therapy, most of it is talking. You know, like sex therapy, a lot of times people assume is, you know, me jumping into bed with people, and that's not what I do. So I would have a discussion with them, and we would talk about where these feelings came from, and we would actively work on basically disputing these beliefs. Like if I believe that an orgasm is evil, let's say that's my belief, and it's been there since I was a child, we would actively work on, but is it really true? What evidence do you have of this? Where did this come from? And over time, we can work on replacing that with something healthier, something that's beneficial to them, where they can reclaim the ability to have pleasure. And in some cases, homeworks would be assigned. You know, I've heard of, you know, assignments of sitting down and just kind of exploring your own body and being familiar with it and accepting it as it is. And for a lot of people, that is very challenging. I know many people don't spend a lot of time getting to know their bodies. And, you know, I invite anybody to just have some time with themselves and exploring themselves and just learning all the things that they like, that they don't like. When it comes to sensations, not in terms of like, oh, I don't like this part of me, it's kind of chunky, I don't like this. It's more like, I love being touched here. I'm not a big fan of being touched over here. And that way we can kind of, A, teach our partners that for later use. And the act of self-pleasure is just so much better. Like when you know all of your parts and how amazing they can feel, the act of masturbation just, it's so much better.
So it can go back to what Dr. Hector Garcia talked about exposure therapy, exposing yourself to that, making yourself get comfortable with touching yourself and feeling yourself and exploring yourself and your body, and it's okay. And so maybe you'll get more and more comfortable with that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you can't give every single person the same exact process of therapy, because there is always going to be some case that's going to be a little bit different. But generally, we would have a lot of conversations regarding that distorted way of thinking about things, and we would actively work on changing it to something that's healthier, and also do the homework assignments. And a lot of in sex therapy, we use a lot of like sensate focus, and just mindfulness can also be used in terms of like really being in the moment, because a lot of people, unfortunately, when they're in the act of doing anything sexual, they're in their heads. And we do a lot of like, we call it like spectatoring, where we kind of have like almost an out of body experience. We start going like, what do I have to do later? You know, what am I going to make for lunch? I don't know if I'm going to, and they just kind of like, poof, they exit themselves in that moment. So oftentimes in therapy, we'll talk about that, and we find ways to kind of be in that moment and in your body so that you can fully experience it and enjoy it, hopefully. And for some people, it is difficult to enjoy it. It's a process. Some people either were taught not to enjoy it, or maybe due to some kind of trauma, it can be difficult to enjoy it. So that's something that's also worked on slowly and very calmly and over time. You don't rush into that kind of work. So I think we are reaching the part where we talk about marriage and relationships and partnerships.
Well,
and
did we talk about women masturbating at all? I don't remember. I know it's not true now, but like an old that I've heard is that women don't masturbate at all.
Well, they don't pee or poop either.
Never fart.
Never. Yeah, It's funny. I was thinking the other day, like, how many times have we been shown women masturbating in movies and television? And I was really struggling to kind of think of a couple of good examples. And the only ones I thought of were either women during like some sort of mental crisis, mental breakdown, or women that were being portrayed in a very, very sexual way. Whereas when men were portrayed masturbating, it was generally seen as a joke, which I found very interesting. It's often used as a punchline, which I think
of Sleepless in Seattle, where Meg Ryan kind of pretend masturbating in the, or orgasm, pretend orgasm in the diner. And then the other joke one kind of that you were referring to was something about Mary, you know, Ben Stiller, and turns into hair gel.
So it's just, it was just a little, I had like a little moment of like, wow, like, why is it that in movies, masturbating is never seen as just something beautiful and something just that we all do, and it's just normal and it's healthy? Why does it always have to be a punchline, something that we joke about, or something that is just seen as weird or funny, or like the crazy guy does it? Like, so, oh yes, American Pie. Yes, that's a great one. But women masturbating, it's an interesting topic. It's not now, generally, from what I've been seeing, sex toys are becoming a little bit more accepted in society. Like, I'm actually seeing ads for them, whereas before, an ad for one, it would be just unheard of. It was unheard of. So now I'm actually seeing a little bit more publicity around it, and I'm liking this new trend, because it's normalizing it of like, yes, people can masturbate. We can engage in self-pleasure. It's okay. It's not weird. Everybody does it. And some people happen to really like toys as well. And there's a huge variety of toys right now for basically anything you could ever dream of. And I find it very interesting. I was looking up toys for people of the trans and non-binary experience, which are a little bit more different. And I found that really, really fascinating. But when it comes to women, generally it'd be dildos is basically the go-to that people think of. And there's just so much more out there that we can experiment with. There's so much out there.
I've also seen like more and more sex toy parties, I think.
Ooh. Yeah, like back in the day we had the Tupperware parties.
So
sex toy parties are definitely a thing, where people come with a lovely variety of shapes and sizes and functions, and it's fabulous. And you know, everyone has their own preferences. Some people don't like anything even remotely phallic, and they go, oh no, and they would rather just go for something smaller, a little petite. There's all sorts of toys that look like lipsticks, and you know, it's just, there's anything you could imagine at this point is out there, which I think is great. For the kinky folk, especially, there's a huge variety of toys that you could possibly use, from simple blindfolds all the way up to really interesting stuff that maybe we can talk about another time, maybe later.
Well, I gotta say that when my wife and I first came out of religion, we went to a sex toy shop one time, and it was our first time doing anything like this together. And we had a ball. We went in there and it was really playful. The person waiting on us was delightful and very knowledgeable. And we were there for a long time and really enjoyed ourselves. It was fun.
For a lot of people, that is one of the scariest, most nerve-wracking experiences they'll ever do. Walking.
We looked at each other. We're like, who are we? You know, but we were super nervous going in, but we did it. We got outside that comfort zone, and I think we both enjoyed it.
It's interesting, because for a lot of people, it's really scary in those first couple of minutes. And then once you walk in, and you see that everyone is just so cool about it. Everyone's so laid back. The people who work there are generally like the nicest, most helpful people you've ever met in your life. And everyone's just like, hey man, whatever floats your boat, you know, you do you and you have fun. And it's amazingly non-judgmental. I think sex shops are amazing tools that we can use to explore all sorts of things that we never even thought of. But when it comes to women and masturbation, you know, I think in general, it should get more approval, but then that's my opinion for masturbation across the board. I think it just needs to be a little bit more vocal in terms of like, we can masturbate just for ourselves. It doesn't have to be for our partners. It doesn't have to be with our partners. If we want to, we can. You choose what you want to do when it comes to your own masturbation. Just have fun with it. Enjoy yourself is basically what I always recommend people. Whatever it is you enjoy doing. So something I like telling people is that just because your partner masturbates, it doesn't mean that it needs to create a distance between you and them. So if the act of your partner masturbating does create a distance, then that's when I would recommend you kind of sitting back and analyzing it a little bit and be like, okay, what do I believe is happening here? And that's where I would really encourage people to do a lot of exploration, because just because your partner masturbates does not mean they love you any less. Does not mean they desire you any less, does not mean that you are not satisfying them in some way, shape, or form. It doesn't mean any of those things. But I encourage everyone to have that conversation with their partner or partners, because it's healthy. And sex is something that is so intimate for a lot of people that it really benefits from creating that trust and that communication. So how about we talk about monogamy. So it's an interesting topic nowadays. In the last, this has been around a while, but I feel like in the last couple of years, it's been more and more accepted that, hey, we don't have to be monogamous if we don't want to. And that for a lot of people is like, it's like mind blowing. A lot of studies out there and a lot of papers have been written and a lot of presentations have been done about the fact that humans just don't seem to be all that monogamous in reality. We really, really, really try to be in a lot of cases, but it just doesn't work for everyone. And yeah, that's fine.
I mean, I can kind of talk to that firsthand because I do a lot of genealogy work, and most recent tool in genealogy is getting your DNA tested. And oh boy, have so many skeletons come out of the closet. In fact, a friend of mine tested their like 94-year-old great aunt, and turns out the father that they thought was the father was not the father.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Well, okay. It's pretty darn common. I think you're hit the nail on the head there.
Well, let's focus our attention a little bit on just the concept of, you know, I think a lot of us were told when we were young that you have your relationship and you stay in that relationship and you make it work no matter what, and you hang in there no matter what, and you're there for years, and that's just it. And it doesn't work that way for a lot of people. And a lot of us were told that at some point in our childhood, whether it be our family, the church, whoever it was that told us that you're in it for life, that's it. I've met plenty of people that were in very long-term relationships, you know, hanging on for dear life in there and just very unhappy. And it, you know, for various reasons, you know, it doesn't always have to be that, oh, we had no sex. But oftentimes when, it's hard to say what came first, the chicken or the egg, when it comes to this type of stuff, of whether the relationship issues started and then the sex went with it, or whether the sex went and then the relationship issues start. It's kind of hard sometimes to kind of see where which one came first. Sometimes they happen simultaneously, sometimes not so much. But monogamy nowadays is purely optional, I would say. You know, it's a personal choice. Some people really, really thrive and they feel good and happy and satisfied in monogamous relationships. Other people don't. And that's where now we have the conversation around open relationships, polyamory, you know, all these. Right now, it's basically whatever makes you and your partners happy. You know, generally, we would recommend that it be something that's known amongst all parties. You know, there's a big difference between open relationships and having an extramarital affair, as they would call it. You know, extramarital affair, whatever that name, I'm not a big fan of. But, you know, it's about communication. Like, if you personally feel that monogamy is not for you, and you are in a committed long-term relationship already with someone, let's say, I'll use that example, because it's one that it's pretty commonly brought into therapy, is that, is I am married to my partner, we've been together, let's say, 10 years, and I just am realizing that I don't think I want to be monogamous anymore. And that would be a topic that you would bring into sex therapy, because then we would have to have a negotiation regarding how strongly do you feel about this? Is this really something you want to do? And then we would have to talk to your partner about how they feel about it. Because if for them it's an absolute no-go, then we need to have a conversation about what's going to happen next, which can be a very difficult conversation. Because if I'm saying it's an absolute must for me, then I may need to make a decision for myself to make sure that I'm happy. And that sometimes can lead to the end of my long-term relationship. And it's sad, but sometimes it's what the person chooses. And other times, it doesn't work that way. Sometimes they do decide to open up the relationship. But before anyone decides to go down that road, which I'm not knocking, I think it's an awesome thing, you need to communicate it. And you need to plan it out in some way, shape, or form, and have it some way kind of planned out of like, okay, this is what we're going to do. Let's sit down and figure it out. And it shouldn't just be meet my new girlfriend. You know, like it shouldn't be just throw them out there like that, please. Let's talk about it first.
That comes Brian, down.
Brian, could I jump in here on a couple of things?
Please.
I want to recommend a book I found just mind blowing. It's called The Myth of Monogamy by Barash and Lipton. It actually looks at the biology of, you know, basically establishes there's almost no monogamous species on the entire planet, and we certainly aren't among those species as humans. The second thing is I want to tag on what you said about alternative non-monogamous relationships, because I've been non-monogamous for 22 years, and I would never go back to being monogamous. However, what I find is so many people see it and think, oh, that's what I should do, without really understanding what it means and what the ethics of it are and how to communicate. And it's really difficult to change the contract of your relationship. If your relationship, so many people we see are married in a church in a religious environment, and they are married under a religious contract, so to speak. It's not written, you know, the marriage contract. But it is written in it's in very strong expectations of how you'll behave. Now, once you get out of religion, how do you renegotiate that contract? And I think I don't know, you probably know better than I, but a vast majority of the people need help in renegotiating that contract. And that's what you're suggesting, I think, is you gotta get a sex therapist, somebody understands this stuff. And you're not probably going to do it all by yourself. And if you do, I've seen so many people fuck it up really bad. Fuck up perfectly good marriages because they don't know how to renegotiate the contract. So I'll stop there.
Another book that's really recommended is Opening Up.
Oh, yeah. It's Tristan Taramino.
So I wholeheartedly agree that it needs to be discussed. Like it's definitely a negotiation. That is first and foremost. It should not be surprise, we're open relationship now. Like that's just not how it works. And generally, like you said, like unfortunately, it does not work for every single relationship. Before someone would choose to go down that road, I would probably sit down with both of them and be like, all right, what do you hope to get from this? What should we be prepared for? Like, what are your absolute no's? What are your absolute yeses? And you have to really, really be clear on boundaries, because once those boundaries are crossed in some way, it can be very challenging to rebuild that trust. And when it comes to open relationships, ethical non-monogamy, poly relationships, there has to be such a strong trust, and like, it's got to be like really strong, because some people, you know, it can be difficult, like emotionally, I would say, for a lot of people if they're not ready for that. So definitely discuss it. Don't do any surprise. No peekaboo, here's a new boy. You know, don't do that. Please don't do that.
But what about maybe this, like, a lot of folks who are not in polyamorous relationships may view it as like a stigma, or as something to kind of, you know, something like gross or whatever. How would you kind of, as a person in a polyamorous relationship, how would one kind of work with the stigma when it comes up?
Stigma from who? Like, are we talking like
family members, let's say. Okay. You know, the conservative family members.
Oh boy. That is a tricky one. Yeah. I've heard of a lot of couples that do decide to open that choose not to inform the family for a good chunk of time for that reason. And they introduce their new partner as more like a friend. But as a long-term recommendation, it doesn't work all that great. It really comes down to like the recommendations of our past presentations of sitting and talking with your family, letting them know, like, look, this was really important for us. This is what makes us happy. We are in a really, really good place in our relationship right now, and we would like your support in this, but we understand if you feel uncomfortable about this. And just see what they have to say. There will be people that don't approve, and sometimes you may need to make some decisions when it comes to that and your relationship with those family members, which is unfortunate. But sometimes there are people that just do not approve in the slightest. Like they see it as just a terrible thing, and you shouldn't be doing this, and it's a sin, or it's just gross, and you know, you can't make everybody happy, unfortunately, and that particularly applies to family members.
Back to the issue of communication, I think no matter what style of relationship you want, whether it's an open relationship, a polyamorous relationship, monogamous, I don't care. You have to decide what works for you, and then you have to create a communication channel that works with your partner as well. And that's the key to all of this. And I don't know about you, Priya, but I've looked at books like Opening Up and The Ethical Slut, and I think, I wish I could get my monogamous friends to read these books, because you fucking learn how to communicate with your partner. You have to learn how to communicate with your partner if you're in some kind of a non-traditional, non-monogamous relationship. But monogamous people don't know how to talk to their partner. They don't know how to renegotiate. They don't know how to talk about how much masturbation is or isn't in my life, and how much of it's my body and me, and how much of it's going to be our bodies together and all that. They just don't know how to do that. Mm-hmm. So even if you're choosing to be a monogamous, which I have nothing against, I'm not pro or con, I'm just neutral, you still need to learn these skills. And those skills are being taught in the poly community and in the fetish community. They are not being taught in the monogamous community. I know that. What's your view on that?
Oh my God. The kink BDSM community is amazing at communicating exactly what they want and exactly what they do not want. They are the best. So I would love some sort of like workshop or something run by someone from the kink BDSM community on just communication in a relationship, because they would be able to tell you like all the do's and don'ts. They are absolutely amazing at it, because that's what they do. It's a constant communication of, I want this, I don't want this, this is a maybe, this is an absolute no, we can negotiate this one. That's what they do constantly. And in a relationship, that's so, so beneficial. Just like every once in a while, just like a check-in with your partner of, hey, how have you been feeling? What do you feel we can work on? What can we improve in this? What are you feeling really good about? What do you hope to achieve coming up? If we could all have that with our partners just on a regular basis, it'd be amazing.
And this is just talking specifically about sex. Like, what do you hope to achieve? How are you doing?
Just in general, when it comes to any sort of relationship, if we could just have that like shared vision of what we hope to have in our relationship moving forward, and then we can kind of throw sex in there too, of like, hey, is there anything you've been maybe wanting to try? I'd love that question. I think that's a fabulous question to ask a partner. Be like, hey, by any chance, is there something you've been curious about? See what they say. They may say something that completely blows your mind, and then you go like, no, not really. What about you? And you can be like, well, now that you ask, and then kind of like, and just like throw out a question, you know, a suggestion there. But it can be differently. It's difficult to have that conversation with every single partner. You know, there's some that can be a little bit more on the shy side about sexuality and not that communicative. So you kind of have to learn your partner's communication style. Some people are very open and they don't mind talking about things. Other people, you have to kind of gently and slowly go around the topic and then eventually get to it. Whew. Alrighty. Porn. Alrighty. Let me get comfy for this one.
We can skip that one since nobody watches porn in this group, I'm sure.
Never. Never heard of it. So, porn. There's nothing wrong with porn. Let's just start there. That's a good way to just start that one. There's nothing wrong with porn. Now, there is an interesting development happening, which is ethical porn, which is very cool, and porn that's feminist. So it's made for women by women, which I am all about. I think it's very cool. Whatever floats your boat, floats your boat. Like, porn is also something that's very individual. Some people like certain things, and some people like other things. Just because I happen to like this particular style of porn does not make it any worse, better, or anything else than this other person's style of porn that they prefer. I don't really see a difference in it. Now, there are certain things that honestly are not porn. Like, for example, child porn is not porn. That is abuse. That we're not even considering that one. So that goes out the window. We're just talking about consensual people recording themselves having sex. That's all we're talking about here. So when it comes to porn, again, there is no such thing as porn addiction. There are people that like to view it probably at amounts higher than what you would consider normal, which again, there's no such thing as a normal amount. I've never heard of anyone designate an amount of porn that you're allowed to watch per day before you reach your max and you got to stop. I've never heard of that. Now, when it comes to porn, a lot of people, it's hard to bring that into a relationship. Some people prefer that to just be, again, with their masturbation. That's just what they do in their alone time. But there are some people that enjoy bringing it into the relationship, and they want to make it something that they can do with their partner. Some people want to make their own porn, but that's another thing. When it comes to watching porn, you can watch that with your partner. And again, it's a negotiation. What would you like to watch? I happen to like this category. What would you like? And you can have porn be a healthy part of your sex life with your partner or by yourself.
Eric, could you pull up that poll?
Yes, the poll.
I'd be interested to see those polls on the questions that we had on porn. And
yeah, number two, did you ever believe that sex or porn could be addictive? 89% of the folks said yes. 8% said no, and 4% were not sure.
Big number.
Yeah, it's a huge number. I want to throw in just a quickie. Go look at the thinking. I think it's on the Thinking Atheist. But I did a talk in Oklahoma and Tulsa about 4 years ago on the myth of sex and porn addiction. Mm-hmm. It's the most viewed talk I ever gave in my career. I think it hit 20 or 30,000 pretty quick after that. But it's a question, and there's so much to be discussed around this. It's a religious idea. The whole notion of addiction to your own body or to your sex behavior, and it's pretty much a religious idea. Anyway, that's my two cents there.
I think another recommendation that we had discussed was Dr. David Lay about the myth of sex.
Absolutely. He's got a great book, yeah.
So when it comes to porn, I think a lot of us were taught that once you start viewing category, softcore, whatever, that over time you would eventually want more and more and get to more hardcore things and you become insatiable and, oh my God, it'd be out of control. I'm not too sure where that idea came from, because that generally is not true. Sometimes we can get a little bit bored for a particular category and venture into other things, but it doesn't mean that frequent viewing is going to turn me into some kind of like porn addict or anything like that. That's going to just, oh my God, be out of control. But oftentimes we are taught that porn is disgusting and it's, all these evil things and it's judged very harshly. Unfortunately, it also leads to people that work in that type of industry to also be judged, and it's just work. There's no reason to judge people for what they enjoy or nor what they decide to do with their lives. That's up to them. But unfortunately, it is often highly judged and stigmatized. When it comes to stereotypes and unrealistic ideas of things, I've met a lot of people that, let's say I didn't receive any sort of sex ed in school. I know the sex ed I got was pretty crappy. Really basic stuff, just nothing. So let's say I just got zero and I decided, let me just use porn to kind of figure out what to do. And that is a horrific choice. I would never recommend anyone to use that as their source of education. It's absolutely unrealistic. And it's very damaging to a lot of people that feel like this is an accurate depiction of what sex is like between people, because it is not. And oftentimes it can create a lot of unhealthy comparisons, both physically. I've had a lot of people tell me that they were comparing their genitalia and their bodies to these people and automatically feeling just inadequate or ashamed because my parts don't look like their parts. And I would never recommend porn. You can enjoy absolutely as long as you don't think this is real life sex, please. That's
we don't go to the movies and think the movies reflects reality.
No, that's a good point.
We don't look at a sitcom and think, is Seinfeld reflecting reality? Oh, and yet people make that kind of stupid assumption. It's just fucking entertainment. And our entertainment can go from Superman on one side to bodybuilding contests on the next side to pornography on another side. It's all entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine once said that sex workers use their bodies, derogatorily. And my therapist friend, Dr. Marty Klein, said, football players use their bodies too, and nobody seems to complain about that. Bodybuilders use their bodies and nobody complains. It's when you add that little twist of sex, it all goes crazy. It all of a sudden is. I'm sorry, Todd, you were going to say something?
No, I was just going to say, Dr. Derry, I don't think you could have said it any better. It's just fucking entertaining, or entertainment.
Pariah, before we go on, could you define sex work and sex workers for us a bit?
Now, it's more of an umbrella term because we can consider like body workers, surrogates, cam girls, you know, there's all these different varieties that you can consider under the umbrella of sex work. I think oftentimes when people use that term, the first thing they think is a prostitute or an escort. And, you know, there's all sorts of sex work that you can consider under there that can do a variety of things. Sex therapists are not sex workers, just in case. We are mental health professionals, just throwing it out there. Nothing against sex workers, but sometimes I will get that question and I'm like, no, I will talk about it, but that's about it. That's pretty much what I do.
So you kind of talked about that porn is not like not a good place to start for folks who are coming out of the purity culture, the whole religious based ideas and ideals that they have, and norms that they've set up. Where would a good place to start learning about this be?
So if you were going to try to use porn as some sort of kind of like a starting point in this thing, I would probably go more for like the feminist variety if I could, because some of them, they'll actually focus more on foreplay and things like that. And it's a little bit more on the intimate side and not so much on close up of genitals during certain moments that traditional porn tends to be. So I would probably, if I wanted to use porn in that way as like my intro to what does sex look like. But there's, depending on where you live, there are places where I'm pretty sure you can go to even workshops on what is masturbation, like Masturbation 101. There are certain places that offer those types of classes. I've heard of even masturbation classes that are offered, you know, mostly I've seen them geared towards women. Yet now there is a, what do they call them? Masturbation clubs for men. What? That you can go and just kind of hang out and, you know, masturbate. No biggie, you know, just a group, just a bunch of dudes, just masturbating. No biggie, no problem. And, you know,
like maybe in the Midwest where it's mostly conservative and opportunities or classes like that may not be quite available.
I'm going to beg to differ there, Eric.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Kansas City has one of the largest fetish communities in the United States. We also have one of the biggest polyamory communities in the entire United States. Hmm. Per capita, they're far bigger than Los Angeles and New York. Now, I'm not saying they're bigger by absolute numbers, but per capita. And I have stories to tell someday. I'll have to tell you those. But I could just say I went to New York City one time to a dungeon and played with a friend of mine. And in talking to the people that were there, they didn't have anything going on compared to what we had going on in Kansas City. And oh, by the way, St. Louis has beat me in St. Louis and Spanksgiving twice a year. And Springfield used to have a pretty rockin' kink community down there. So no, I think in some ways, the more conservative the area is, the more it's underground, but it's there and it's pretty vibrant. I was Joplin, even of all places, had a interesting group. So I don't know. What's your idea on that, Priya?
I like the fact that you said that they're there, but they're underground, which I think is a pretty accurate way to put it, because I live in New York. So over here, things are pretty out in the open. Generally, it's kind of like, oh yeah, it's a sex club, no biggie. And, you know, like they're all over the place. But I feel like in other places, if they were to openly advertise as that, it may attract certain negative attention. So maybe they do purposely keep it a little bit more on the covert side. But I feel like with enough gigging, like there's websites, for example, FetLife, that you can join that advertise a lot of events and they have a lot of groups. The website is not perfect in any way whatsoever, but it's a pretty cool place to start if you are looking for parties and groups. And oftentimes I'll see classes. Often I've always wanted to go to one. I haven't been to one yet, of like a Dom class where they keep, you know, teach you like the basics of, you know, BDSM and all these things if you want to kind of maybe dip your toe in. And I always recommend, if possible, if you have access to one of these classes with a pro, go for a pro and, you know, go to some kind of workshop where they can really teach you how to do things, because they know how to do it in the best, safest way, right, where no one gets hurt. And if you do get hurt, it's only because they want to get hurt, and it's not hurt because it was done improperly. Yeah, so if you can, you know, definitely, if you're interested in that, there are websites that you can join to kind of look for these things. The parties, I actually have an article, I think called Bait Clubs, I think is what they called them. It's interesting. Or Facebook for Masters, they called it in one place, which is cool.
If you ever go to a kink convention or a poly convention or any of those kind of, it's like going to any other convention. They have workshops, they have lectures, they have experts there, and you will learn from people who've been doing it for decades. And then in the evening, you get to go and do it yourself under the supervision of pros. So it's just, it's an amazing experience. The first time I went to a kink convention, I could hardly believe my eyes. There were like 600 people there. They had rented the entire hotel. They would not let anybody in that wasn't pre-registered and prepaid. And they had two policemen at the front, so nobody was coming in without, you know, without having the right credentials. And the education, I learned all sorts of stuff. The education was phenomenal. And it was just a weekend. But it's all very carefully, it's very safe. They have dungeon masters. They have people around there that are responsible for making sure everybody behaves themselves. And they will enforce the rules in a heartbeat. You are safer inside that hotel than you probably are anywhere else at that particular time.
And if you want to just go for an environment where you would like to meet people that are kinky and into BDSM, but you don't want to just like jump in and go to like a dungeon or something, you can go to a munch. Munches are places where it's a meetup, generally at a restaurant. You just go and you hang out with people that happen to be kinky, and you just talk to them, and there's no one takes off their clothes, no one does anything. You're in a restaurant, and you just get to socialize and get comfortable and maybe exchange contact information if you click with somebody or not. There's no obligation to. And you can have a nice time with people and learn things. And that's a really nice way to also kind of start your journey into kink, if that's what you're into. Before we jump into the tips, I'm not sure if maybe this would be a good topic for a future talk, but when it comes to STDs and things like that, or STIs, as they're more commonly known now, we kind of took out the D in it, now we keep it STI. I feel like maybe that would be a good topic to discuss, of the stigma around that. Certain STIs have just such a horrific stigma. And nowadays, with the advances in medicine, and there's no reason to stick, like, there's just no reason. You can have an absolutely healthy, happy life. A healthy, happy sex life absolutely is possible now, you know, with any sort of diagnosis that you may have. Unfortunately, a lot of people feel that once they are diagnosed, life is over and that's it. Like they shut down and that's it. And I know from personal experience, that's not true. And there are so many amazing places where you can meet people in your same situation. And just because you have a particular diagnosis does not mean that you are not worthy of having love or worthy of having a happy, healthy sex life. So I don't know if maybe in a future talk, we can kind of talk about that. But I think it was a kind of important little mini side note to kind of throw in there just in case. Because I know for a lot of people that I've talked to about that topic, they see it as a large barrier to having a happy relationship with someone, because the stigma of disclosing oftentimes leads them to not even try. When it comes to time, how are we looking, guys?
Running a little close to the line. Do you maybe have any tools or tips that you can kind of leave us with? About 15 minutes before we head to the Q&A session.
Okay, cool. So some of these we've kind of touched on a little bit. So the first tip I always encourage is the one I mentioned of exploring your own body and coming to terms with it fully. For a lot of people, this is difficult. Some of us have a lot of, you know, trauma when it comes to our own body, or we have a lot of misconceptions about certain things about our bodies. Oftentimes I have conversations with people of like, oh, I just don't like the way I look here. And I feel like someone's going to look at me a certain way, or they're going to judge me about this and this and this. So I always encourage step one is just to be comfortable with yourself, whether that be looking yourself in a mirror, using your hands, doing whatever it is that you feel comfortable doing to kind of really get a good feel for your own body and all of the wonderfulness that it can provide you. Give yourself permission to have a less than perfect sex life. I think a lot of times we beat ourselves up for not getting things perfect every single time. Like, for example, there may be times where you're having an amazing sexual experience and you do not orgasm. Just happens. It just happens. And a lot of people, we beat ourselves up for it. And we start wondering, oh my God, why and who, and oh, is this going to happen next time? And we start creating this anxiety around it. And oftentimes the anxiety can lead to it happening more, because now we've got ourselves worked up. So it's okay to have those sessions that are not perfect. It's all right. We all go through it at one point or another. And it does not mean anything particular about you. Don't worry about it. If it does become something that is frequent, then that would be something that you may want to discuss with a sex therapist. You may want to discuss it with your doctor if it's something that's really, really concerning you. But I'd encourage everybody to kind of like take it a little easy when it comes to expectations. A lot of times, and we can refer back to the porn, like not every session is going to be 45 minutes just like bam bam bam. Like sometimes it, you know, it's going to be five. On average, I think the average session is 5 minutes long, or maybe a little bit less. So it's okay. We don't always have to be these marathon session people. That's fine. So
it's like pizza, you know, whether it's cheese pizza or the fully loaded pizza, it's still pizza.
Oh boy.
And cheese pizza is just as good sometimes. So
all right. Maybe.
Maybe.
I don't know. I've had some pretty crappy pizza in my day, so I don't know about that.
Okay, maybe it was a bad example.
Have an open and honest conversation about what excites you. So maybe you are going to be excited by something that someone else would consider quote unquote taboo. All right, what to do with that? Be open and honest about it. If you're into something that your partner isn't too familiar with or is a little uncomfortable with, have a conversation of what that means to you. See if it's something that you can slowly and, you know, involve them with. If they go, no, not with me, then fantasy is generally something that I like to recommend. For me, there's absolutely nothing wrong with a huge library of fantasies. It's a fantasy. It's in your head. There's absolutely nothing wrong with things being in your head. Like, enjoy it. You can do anything you want as long as it's in your head. So in some cases, I'll have to work with people on really creating a fantasy that is satisfying to them if they feel it's something that they cannot do in real life. But if you do have a partner and something that you want to involve them with, then you might have to have that really open conversation about, look, I would like you to do this for me. And what do you feel about this? And what's your opinion about this? And then negotiation, that's where the negotiation comes into play. But it's about being open and honest, because the longer we push down certain desires, it can definitely impact the way we feel, like sexually, just with ourselves, with relationships, and it's not very beneficial. If you have identified like an area that you feel you need help with, reach out. Like I encourage anybody, if it's something that you've explored, you've done maybe a little bit of internal reflection on it, you've maybe talked to, I don't know if you talked to a friend about it, if you have a friend that you can talk to about certain things like this, or you know, whoever it is that you have in your life, maybe your partner, you talk to them about it, and you said, okay, this is something that I think I need outside assistance with, then please contact the therapist. So we can kind of bounce around some ideas, particularly if it's a sex therapist and you come in saying like, I need help with my premature ejaculation. Be like, okay, cool. What do you want to be able to do? And then we'll work with you with it. And we don't judge and we don't say anything in there that's going to make you feel like you're inferior or any kind of things that oftentimes is it's the message that we get when it comes to sexuality. If I'm a person that does not get satisfaction from certain things that other people think I should get satisfaction from, all automatically people put a stamp on me that, oh, I'm just messed up. And that's not true. And when it comes to our sexuality, we can define what we want it to be. If for me to be happy sexually, I am happy with just doing whatever I want to do, and I don't want a serious relationship, and I just want to meet people and have fun and just kind of do my own thing, then that's fine. I'm not hurting anybody. Why is that such a problem? I don't understand. But unfortunately, we are given this message of what's expected of us, and it can be very difficult to break away from that. Last but not least, do your best to keep in mind that, and here we get a little bit existential, because right now we're dealing with a difficult time. A lot of people are going through some changes thanks to all this isolating and quarantining and all this fabulousness that's involved. So some of us are experiencing some changes when it comes to our sexuality. Maybe a little bit less here, a little bit more here. It's all over the place right now. So I encourage everyone to do your best to keep in mind, we don't know what's going on right now, and it's very difficult to, we don't have a lot of control on what's happening right now. So I would encourage anybody to do your best to just kind of release the need to control things. When it comes to sex, a lot of times that need to control is still there, and it can lead to some issues, especially when it comes to, like, for example, with women or people that identify as women, it's hard for us to let go of control in some situations, which can lead to difficulty in reaching orgasm. So oftentimes we have to work a lot on the fact that you are letting go of control does not mean that you're out of control. And there's a big difference of that one. And right now we don't have a lot of control over what's happening. Do your best to stay calm, breathe, have pleasure. I'm encouraging everyone to experience pleasure in any way you can. If your way of experiencing pleasure is through your sexuality, and right now you are masturbating maybe a little bit more than normal, or whatever your normal is, or you're having sex with your partner a little bit more than you normally do, awesome. Don't worry about it. Don't judge it. Don't try to analyze it of like, oh, why am I doing this? Right now, we are going through a collective, immensely stressful experience. Odds are your sexuality is a little different at this particular moment. Don't worry about it. Don't judge it. Don't do any of this, okay? So with that, I think we're ready for question and answers. Are we ready to jump into this?
Yes, we absolutely are. We've got some book recommendations for further exploring on the topic. I'm going to pop those into the chat. There's going to be some websites. We've got a lot of resources for you. It's a little bit too much to put in the chat. But what we will do is put all of these resources into the video when this comes out onto YouTube. So be sure to find and subscribe to the YouTube channel to kind of get even more out of these RFRX talks. All right. Priya, Dr. Darrell, Dr. Ray, this was such a great talk, and we've had quite a bit of activity in the chat. One of the kind of the first questions I wanted to ask, which kind of goes back to the recommendations, is we have a person who has a young daughter and is looking for recommendations for a good book to teach her about sex.
I'm not sure if I have any off the top of my head. I might need to do a little bit of digging. Is it specifically on like sex ed, like boundary setting, I guess?
I'm imagining kind of like I'm a parent. I've got a daughter growing up. Do you have a book that can kind of help be better than what she might be getting in school?
Most things would be better than that. All right. Should we post that in the link for the video, you think?
Yeah, I can put that into the YouTube. Absolutely.
I used two books with my children, written by, and I just drew a blank on the name. He was a student of Alfred Kinsey's. So the book was written in the 70s, so it's pretty old, 70s, 80s. And one of the books was called Sex and Girls. The other book is called Sex and Boys. And it's written directly for the child, at the child's level. And I bought and gave a copy to each of my kids when they, just before they turned adolescents. I don't remember exactly, but not the book I'm referring to.
Okay, all right.
But I recommend it cautiously because it's pretty old. However, I don't remember it being I don't remember any inappropriate or bad information in it. After all, it was written by a student of Kinsey, so it's probably pretty accurate in most ways. But I'm sure there's, I haven't been around that kind of literature in a long time. I'm sure there's better stuff and more recent stuff. Maybe probably can come up.
You know, in our resources under the secular parenting, there's actually a section in there for parents with articles and resources to help parents raise their kids without religion. And I will drop that link in the chat for people. And I think you can go in there and there's books in there. I'm not sure if it's on sex or not, but it might be a good resource for people.
Maybe I can look up some books because I've been doing a little bit of research on also working with children that are of the trans and non-binary experience. So I've been looking up those. Maybe I can include those in there as well.
We got another question here. Growing up in religion, I never really learned how to emotionally connect with my spouse during sex. How would I develop that? How would I work on that?
I would probably work on some mindfulness when it comes to like emotionally connecting. That's a little bit complicated to really see. Like, I would probably work with them, the person individually, and kind of see what beliefs they have regarding sex. Like, is it that for some reason they were taught that it's something that's threatening? Is it something that, you know, is fear? Like, I would really work individually with the person first before really diving into assignments in the bedroom, because that sounds like it's something is kind of standing in the way when it comes to the intimacy could be. I'd be very interested in kind of doing that first. And it may be that process of allowing that person to give themselves in that moment. I know a lot of people, they have difficulty with being vulnerable in that moment, because it can be a very vulnerable moment for a lot of people, and it can be very threatening for a lot of people as well. So I would probably work first on that individually over time, get a little bit comfortable with it. It could be that the first series of activities in the bedroom would be very like sensate focused and kind of touch and doing all that and connecting with themselves in that moment of like, when this person is touching me here, what am I feeling? What am I thinking? And kind of taking a deep breath and doing all that. And then like progressively working up to the actual like act of having sex and then also connecting and like being present in the moment.
I agree with probably about doing the preliminary work with something. I want to throw one piece out here, and that is that sometimes people have different understandings of what it means to emotionally connect.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have unreasonable expectations about what it means to emotionally connect. And some people have been raised with this notion that every time you have sex, it's got to be mind-blowing and so connecting, so meaningful and spiritual even. In fact, the Christians do that bullshit all the time. Sex should be spiritual. And so I had Sunday school teachers tell me, oh, yeah, we have the greatest spiritual sex. And only to find out 30 years later, they hadn't had sex in 30 or 40 years. they were lying to me, basically, about their... So there's expectations of what sex is. And I think those underlying basic beliefs that Brian mentioned earlier have to be explored. And that's probably what Brian would do, I'm guessing, Brian. If you were working with that individual, you'd want to explore, what does it mean to be emotionally connected?
Mm-hmm.
What were you taught? And we would examine, are those rational ideas or are they myths that you picked up from your culture or from your childhood religion?
Mm-hmm. And oftentimes you have to go just the beginning of what do you consider sex? Because oftentimes even that definition can be like, oh, sex is just, you know, penetrative. And it's like, okay, well, what about oral sex? What about this? And what about masturbation? Are those considered sex to you? And oftentimes just their definitions is something that you can explore. And yeah, like it's, for me, it boils down to our beliefs. And if I believe that the minute I make eye contact with my partner during the act of having sex, it means something that scares me, I'm not going to do it. And all of a sudden I may create something in my head that says that, oh, I'm not connecting with this person emotionally. It means I don't love them. And now I'm creating a story, and it can be very scary.
Something that is on the same type of topic, maybe could one of you all address maybe healthy ways to address sexual shame, especially the people that are maybe just freshly coming out of religion, were raised in the purity culture?
Mm. I don't know, Daryl, if you have more experience with people that are fresh out of it.
Well, that's why I wrote my book, Sex and God, because I wanted to help people learn how to deal with the shame and the guilt cycle that comes out of religion. There's a lot of things that you could probably do. But I think the first is just have to admit to yourself out loud that I feel shame around sexuality, and then start exploring that a little bit, giving yourself permission to explore it. It's impossible. I don't know who asked the question, but it's impossible for Pri and I, or I, either one, to give somebody advice on how to start that process. But you have to first admit you've got it, that I have this incredible shame or guilt, and that is not based in reality. It's not based on a rational analysis of what bisexuality should be. Once you've done that, then you can move and find somebody to help you, find a therapist that can help you, or even a good friend that's sex positive. Sometimes just talking about, you don't have to go to a therapist to talk about sex, but do talk to somebody who is sex positive and has some knowledge, and then read some of these books that we're recommending. There's so much out there. Like I said earlier, The Ethical Slut or Opening Up or More Than Two, any of these books are all excellent for forcing you to really challenge your upbringing and your belief structure, and that'll start getting at the shame. I've known people who said I'm an atheist for 30 years and I still have trouble admitting I masturbate, Well, that tells me that they have not challenged themselves to address that shame and open it up, look at it, expose themselves to some new ways of thinking, try some things, you know, expand their behavioral patterns a little bit. I've had people tell me I watch porn every day and I would never admit it to my wife. Well, okay, but your wife, you know, so that tells me there's something about the communication style in your marriage. So there's just a lot of things like that we could work on. I won't go on any farther. Priya, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, you reminded me of the, I think it was the last question on the poll of like, if you ever feel that you're being watched. And if I feel that there's a strong possibility that God is watching me as I masturbate every single time, odds are I'm not going to feel very comfortable about that. And I'm going to, it just doesn't make any sense to me. Like, of course, it's probably going to lead me to either not do it anymore, which can be very, very difficult for most people, or every single time I do it, I'm going to beat myself up. And I'm going to be like, oh my God, I failed again. I'm so terrible. I'm never going to get this right. I'm so sorry. And it can create a lot of unnecessary stress.
Guilt and shame actually create more of the behavior that you supposedly don't want. I mean, we see that a lot of times. It's a driver of behavior. What are you going to say?
We've got a few more questions, but we're running low on time here. Maybe we can put together a second kind of follow-up RFRX to this one, because we kind of tackled a huge topic here. And I think there's a lot more that we can explore. The last question is... And it's a little heartbreaking, but I think you can kind of point to a larger stigma too, from the other end. I contracted herpes from my ex-husband, and I haven't been sexual for 2 years because of this. I'd like to date women, but feel tainted for life, and sex is something I don't think of because of the disclosure procedures around herpes. I'd like to be sexual with same-sex a partner, but where would I start from?
So I would definitely recommend, if you are open to going to therapy, it would be a good idea just to really work on, again, the stigma around STIs, which I mentioned it just makes no sense at this point. There's treatment for it. You know, herpes gets so much stigma, and it's just a couple of, like, it's so completely manageable, and people treat it like you're a leper. And I know that from experience. And if dating is something that is stressful, there's several dating sites out there right now for people with STIs, because the stress of having to disclose is so strong that people prefer just not to do it at all. So they just either don't date or they choose to not disclose, which can often lead to a lot of extra anxiety. So there's a lot of dating sites out there right now for people with STIs where it just says it right there, diagnosed with this, no biggie. And it just eliminates completely the stress of having to disclose. And it makes it easier.
There's also some interesting statistics that maybe upwards to 22% of the people actually have herpes 2, and maybe 60 or 70% have herpes 1. And oh, by the way, the testing is a very difficult time telling between the two. So I don't know. What's your thoughts on that, Priya?
I love asking people when's the last time they were actually tested for herpes, because odds are they never have been, because most doctors never do, because almost everyone has some form of it. And most people are asymptomatic. They never show any sort of symptoms. Right. So they could live their lives and just not even know. So some people do show symptoms, and that's generally where they would test you, and then you would come up, okay, you have it, and they may prescribe you some medication. But most people never get tested for it. The doctors, I've spoken to several that have told me they choose not to not cause unnecessary anxiety in people, because it's just something that almost everyone has. So a lot of people, they would prefer almost to have lived in kind of like blissful ignorance that they even had it from the beginning. So STIs are completely manageable, and especially herpes. Like, it just, between herpes and HIV, oh my God, they're so manageable, and you can have such a happy life, and you don't need to hide yourself or feel like you are unworthy of having any sort of happy relationship. You absolutely do. So I would definitely encourage you to reach out to someone to talk to really work on that shame, and then get out there when you're ready. You know, don't rush it. There's no need to rush it. But when you're ready, get out there. Start meeting some awesome people.
Awesome. Guys, thank you so much. Priya, Dr. Ray, thank you so much for coming today. I think this was, I know for me personally, it was awfully helpful. And I really appreciate the time that you've taken to share your knowledge with us.
Thank you.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, Healing, and Support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.